From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you up to date on the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panelists include Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Nate Eaton, news director at eastidahonews.com. Hey, happy Friday, everybody.
Woo, happy Friday.
Good to see you.
All right. Let's, I think, start with the big story right now, which, oh my goodness, is the weather. The snow is coming down. The temperatures are dropping. It is winter outside. So, Nate, I want to head over to East Idaho with you first because you're under a blizzard warning.
Yeah, this is kind of a rare thing. The last time we had a blizzard warning was around Christmas time in 2016. And I think there's been a handful that have been issued over the past decade or so. So many areas right now are getting slammed with snow here in eastern Idaho. I would say the bigger issue is the wind kicking up old snow, making it so several highways are currently closed. A lot of side roads are closed. The National Weather Service said if you do not have to be outside, then don't go. Stay home, work from home if you can. And this blizzard warning extends for most of eastern Idaho, even into central Idaho, and some places could get up to 15 inches of snow. Some places it expires this afternoon at 2, others it goes into tomorrow. So it is definitely winter. Winter is here.
I have to tell you, Nate, I worked in East Idaho. I was a news reporter at KIDK years ago in the mid-90s, right out of college. And the only time I have literally ever been in true whiteout conditions was right outside of Idaho Falls when there was a blizzard going on. And it is, it's that blowing snow that, I mean, you honestly cannot see anything.
Yeah, there's so many fields. And I think you could not even realize what you're about to hit. If you're driving down the street and everything's fine, you hit an open field, the road could have, you know, 10 to 15 inches of snow. And if you try to drive through, you're going to get stuck, which has happened to several people this morning. So We're under that blizzard warning. It will last through the rest of today for many parts and then into the weekend. And then there's going to be wind chill factors. It's going to get very, very cold and fill in the negative temperatures because of the wind.
Yeah. All right. So, Christina, let's head over to this side of the state in western Idaho, the Treasure Valley. As I look outside, it is snowing. It hasn't stopped snowing. And I'm wondering, I'm actually not looking forward to having to pick my children up from school today. But what is, right? I mean, oh my goodness. So what's expected in our forecast?
I've been waiting to go out and shovel, and it has not stopped since I woke up this morning. I read with interest Sean Goodwin's story in the Statesman today about Boise Code actually asked that all of their residents shovel their snow by 9 a.m. and maintain throughout the day. So sorry, City of Boise, that hasn't happened for me at least today. But
That's not happening.
I'm calling the cops on you, Christina.
But I would say that, you know, I think Idahoans should really familiarize themselves with the 511.idaho.gov website. It will discuss all of those closures that Nate mentioned on a map. You can get real-time information about the routes you're traveling. And the National Weather Service from Boise tweeted out that the heaviest snowfall and travel impacts are really this band, and it almost follows I-84 almost exactly. So if you're traveling to the Twin Falls area or from Twin Falls to Boise, that's really where the snow is hitting the most, and to be extra careful along those routes. And, you know, it's just one of those things that stay home if you can, if you don't have to be anywhere or cancel your plans, because it does look pretty bad out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does. And I have to say, I think every child in the Treasure Valley was quite upset when they had to be woken up this morning to be told that they did have to go to school. And now I'm literally looking out the window, and I have enjoyed my children being back in school, but would have been nice to have a snow day today. Okay, yeah. With that said, I mean, honestly, it is coming down out here, folks. So as Christina said, that 511 is super important right now. The other big story this week, this was the Idaho legislature. It is back in session. The governor gave his State of the State address on Monday afternoon to kick the session off. And Melissa and Scott, I know you both have covered this, So I'd love both of your thoughts. So Melissa, why don't we start off with you and kind of what were the key takeaways that you saw in this State of the State address?
The big proposal that stood out to me and lawmakers both was a $2 billion school facilities investment. That $2 billion would be over the next 10 years. And annually, we'd be looking at some of that coming from, some of that going directly to school maintenance with match funds, and some of that going for bonding. Those proceeds would be distributed to local school districts for new school facility construction. It's a wonky thing, but the important thing is a lot of Idaho school facilities are really struggling with maintenance, with growth, with building new facilities in the first place. It's been the subject of a lot of local and national attention. There was a phenomenal report last month, I think, partnership between the Statesman and ProPublica about some of the really unsafe facilities across the state, right? And I'm hard pressed to think of another one of Governor Little's proposals in past State of the States that got standing ovations from lawmakers, but the school facilities proposal on Monday got a rare standing ovation. And so that stands out to me as something that, you know, even if lawmakers tweak it, they're highly motivated to address that this year.
Well, and I think, as you said, Melissa, I mean, when we talk about infrastructure with schools, I mean, there has been a lot of reporting done on this, in particular with the last election in November, when so many school districts tried to get these bonds passed so that they could, you know, make improvements to, I mean, to we're talking school facilities that some even have like really like raw sewage, not to be, you know, too graphic, but I mean, that's what we're dealing with in some of these instances. So with all of that said,
specifically raw sewage that was underneath a floor in a cafeteria in the Salmon School District. It's a pretty remarkable anecdote from Governor Little traveling the state, one of the things that he saw personally.
So with that said, though, Melissa, even though we get the standing ovation, I mean, $2 billion, I mean, what do you think is the likelihood that this ask is going to be met?
Again, that's over the course of 10 years, right? So we're not looking at $2 billion in general funds in the next fiscal year. We're looking at that over the course of 10 years. It's a big ask, of course, but it's something that is a high priority for lawmakers. Education is Governor Little's biggest priority. We saw that, you know, again, with how much time he spent touting the launch program and how many high school seniors are interested in that. And so it's something that local school districts have been asking for help on for years now. This is not a new problem. You don't get, you know, from a new school to raw sewage under the cafeteria floors in a couple of years. Yeah. This is a long simmering issue. It's a funding puzzle that local school districts have tried to solve by going to voters. And as you mentioned, a lot of them have not succeeded in those efforts. And so whether what we see at the end of session is this $200 million annually, or if it's something else, I do anticipate we're going to see something on facilities this year, but the lawmakers, you know, like they do with so many of Governor Little's proposals, may tweak that. It may look different by the end of March or beginning of April.
So Scott, let's bring you into the conversation. What were your thoughts and takeaways from Monday's State of the State address?
Yeah, I think just to pause a minute on that $2 billion school facilities, Governor Little, you know, touted that as a property tax relief proposal, which he's absolutely right, because school maintenance and new school facilities are borne by property tax payers. So you ask about, you know, the likelihood of this passing, of legislature approving it. I think, you know, I've been covering Idaho politics for 17 years and crumbling school buildings for 17 years. And the year-long project that Becca Savransky of the Idaho Statesman did with ProPublica in the past year really put it all together. So I think all these legislators, they recognize that there was a problem in their individual districts, but this kind of put it all together and recognized it as a statewide problem. And if this is approved by the legislature, it would indeed result in a $2 billion property tax relief. Some of the other things that I saw, some of the highlights, like Melissa mentioned, the Idaho launch funded by $75 million in Governor Little's proposal, another $200 million for dilapidated bridges, and a $50 million kind of starter fund to leverage $800 million in bonds for other infrastructure projects. One of the other proposals that Governor Little mentioned specifically in his speech was $25 million for a construction of a secure forensic mental health facility to care for those who are deemed dangerously mentally ill. Audrey Dutton of ProPublica last year had a phenomenal report about Idaho being one of only two states in the nation that houses dangerously mentally ill patients in state prison. And we're about to become the last state because New Hampshire has approved its own mental health facility. So Governor Little put that in his budget request. And again, we'll see if the legislature approves that. That's been on the table before for decades, really. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see if this is the year that that finally comes to fruition.
Now, Melissa, can you talk to us about your conversation that you recently had with former Trump Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, as well as former Idaho Senator Larry Craig?
Mick Mulvaney was in town this past week for a short period of time to pitch Idaho lawmakers on a balanced budget amendment and signing on, calling for what's called an Article 5 convention. Basically, that's when two-thirds of the state pass resolutions to say we want to amend the Constitution. It's a wonky way to say both Mulvaney and Senator Craig really want to get people on board to pass this balanced budget amendment that would require Congress to get rid of their practice of deficit spending, lower or eliminate the national debt, and do what most of the states do already, which is pass balanced budgets every single year. There are a lot of concerns with that, both with an Article 5 convention that opens up the Constitution for amendments, which some people might not like. There are no parameters in the Constitution about what a convention can and can't do. There are also concerns about using this route to try and reduce the government debt in the first place. Senator Craig has been pitching this since the Reagan administration. I found a C-SPAN clip of him from 1992 having the same conversation. And at the time, the national debt was, I don't want to say only $4 trillion, but right. It's grown by $30 trillion since then. There was a lot more bipartisan support at the time for such an amendment. There was the national spending was in much better shape, you know, coming out of Bush senior years and into the Clinton administration. There were 2 years where there was no deficit spending at all. And so this hill has gotten a lot steeper to climb mm-hmm. at this point. That said, concern about the national debt has also grown along with the debt in the first place. And so more states are becoming interested in signing on to this. I believe right now they're at 28 states who have called for an Article 5 convention under the two-thirds requirement. They need, I think it's 34, and they're looking at Idaho as potentially the next state. So we have that conversation with Mick Mulvaney and Larry Craig tonight on Idaho Reports. It airs at 8 o'clock on Idaho Public Television, and you can find it at idahoptv.org/Idaho Reports after it airs.
Okay. Nate, Chris Tapp's death is now being investigated as a homicide. Before we get into those details, though, for folks who may not be familiar with Chris Tapp, fill us in, because I tell you, this development is just heartbreaking.
Yeah, so many twists and turns in this story. Chris Tapp, when he was a young man back in 1997, he was convicted by a jury for the rape and murder of Angie Dodge, an 18-year-old Idaho Falls girl who was killed in her apartment. He then said he didn't do it, and the Innocence Project got involved along with some local attorneys in Idaho Falls. And after years and years of appeals and DNA evidence and genetic genealogy being brought into it, he was released from prison 20 years later in 2017. And then in 2019, he was completely exonerated. after they found the man who really did kill Angie Dodge. His name is Brian Drips. They found him, and he's now serving a life sentence. So Chris Tapp served 20 years in prison. He got out of prison in 2019. He did sue the city of Idaho Falls. They came to a settlement. He received around $11 million back in 2022. And Chris Tapp died at the age of 47 back in November. And now, just this week, he died in Las Vegas. Originally, they said that he hit his head, that it was an accident. But just this week, Las Vegas police have said that their homicide unit is officially investigating Chris Tapp's death. Wow. They have not named a suspect yet. I do know that several people who were with him that night in Las Vegas are being interviewed by police, and that they have their eye on a few people. But just a tragic turn of events, especially for his mother, Vera Tapp, who, you know, has been by him. She's elderly now, lives alone. And just to just go through this, it's just been so heartbreaking for her.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, and this was just such a case that I think got so much, you know, attention over the years. I mean, I was a reporter actually in Idaho Falls, Nate, when Angie Dodge was killed. And I remember this so well. And, you know, and then years later to see Chris finally get exonerated and go free, you hope for the best for him, right? And so something like this, as I said, it's just, it's so tragic in a life that had such trauma in it.
Oh, without a doubt. And this case received national attention. You know, multiple documentaries have been done about it. There's been, you know, Dateline NBC's done several shows on it. And it was, I believe, the first, if not the first, one of the first cases to be solved or at least changed with genetic genealogy, where through the help of a family tree and gathering genetic DNA from family members, they were able to find the real person that did this. And also, I should note, just a few months before Chris died, his wife, they were going through a divorce at the time, she passed away in a car crash. And so it's been one thing after another that has definitely, you know, caught the attention of so many. And now there'll be another murder trial, we would assume, in Las Vegas, assuming they arrest and charge somebody with the crime.
Yeah, just tragic. Thanks, Nate. So, Melissa, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be taking up Idaho's lawsuit. This is surrounding EMTALA. Before we talk about the impacts that this will have on Idahoans, fill us in on what EMTALA is.
It's the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And what it is a federal guidance for emergency rooms that receive certain funding. And it is the subject of a Department of Justice lawsuit against Idaho concerning its abortion bill. So EMTALA covers a multitude of things in emergency room settings. How it applies to Idaho in this case is our near total abortion ban, and how it accounts for abortions required to save the life of the mother, but not the health of the mother. That raised concerns for emergency room doctors who were concerned about preserving the health of the mother. At what point, you know, do you say a woman's life is in danger? Is it when there's the potential there, or when she's actually on her deathbed? Emergency room doctors who were really concerned about the threat of prosecution if a pregnant woman needed an abortion to preserve her fertility after she had been in a car accident or another emergency situation. This was a lawsuit that was filed in 2022, shortly after Idaho's abortion ban went into effect, and has been going for a year and a half now in the lower courts.
So my understanding, Melissa, and we did, we talked about this a bit on Idaho Matters earlier with a constitutional lawyer as well as an OBGYN, but since SCOTUS got involved with this, my understanding is that they have now basically put a stay on this. And so even though up until this point, women who were in these situations could access abortion care, that is now on hold, correct? I mean,
there was an injunction so there was the law, and the lower courts put an injunction on that law. And then the Supreme Court agreeing to hear this case scheduled for April, they put a stay on that injunction. Basically, the law is in full effect now, right? So emergency room doctors in those rare situations where a woman might need an abortion to preserve her health. They're no longer protected by the lower court ruling.
Okay, so we now are waiting until April. That's when they'll take this case up.
They're scheduled to take it up in April, and then we'd have to wait for the ruling, for that term. Those rulings usually come out in, you know, early to mid-summer. And so we've got another 6 or so months before we get a resolution to this, most likely. You know, I'm not on the Supreme Court. I'm not an attorney, but from my understanding of how this schedule works, that's how we can, that's probably what we can anticipate. And remember, this doesn't just affect Idaho. This affects how every other state interprets or is affected by EMTALA and how they can then proceed to write their own legislation, depending on how this ruling shakes out.
Let's head over to the Idaho legislature, because library books are once again top of mind for at least some lawmakers. Now, talk to us about this bill that was introduced this week, and this is about allowing for damage claims against what's being called harmful material. And I believe, is this similar to a bill that they tried to get passed last session?
It is very similar. Yeah, it's a bill that allows parents and guardians to sue for damages against libraries for what they would determine is harmful material. There are some key changes to the bill this year. One of them is a limit of $250 per offense. And the other change is that it would allow the library to remove the books to an adult section within 30 days, so that if they rectify the situation within 30 days, then they wouldn't be subject to this challenge. Those changes are meant to address a couple of concerns that Governor Brad Little had last year when he vetoed the bill. So the bill last year had passed the House and the Senate, and Governor Little vetoed it, and it failed to pass the supermajority threshold to override the veto last session. So these changes are meant to address some of those concerns, one of those being that it would bankrupt library districts, that there are library districts who can't stand, who don't have enough money to defend itself against such lawsuits. So capping the dollar amount at $250 is supposed to address those concerns. Given those changes, given the fact that they passed the House and the Senate last year, and then didn't overcome the veto by one vote, we can probably see this land on the governor's desk again. Whether the governor vetoes it or not, I don't know. It might be a source of horse trading that he might say, I'll sign your library bill if you give me the mental health facility or something like that. But I suspect this is going to be one of those bills that might be a subject of some horse trading in the legislature.
Well, and it's always so interesting to me when bills like this come up, Scott, because when we talk about, you know, parent choice, right? Which some days is a big thing in Idaho, some days apparently it isn't. And, you know, it's one of these things where it's like, if you as a parent don't want your children to see these materials, you actually don't have to let them see these materials.
Right. And I mean, there's a recognition that kids go to the library by themselves and they will check out books themselves. And, but I do think it is ironic that, that conservatives will often bring up the nanny state, that the government shouldn't be a nanny state. And a bill like this is clearly a nanny state type of bill. So there is a little bit of hypocrisy here. And again, I question whether there really is such a big problem that the legislature even needs to be spending its time on something like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to head over and talk about some other legislative news. And Nate, you have covered this, and this is interesting. Tell us about this bill that's been introduced that addresses what mortuaries can do with unclaimed ashes. I have to tell you, I have never thought, I guess, that ashes go unclaimed.
I know. This is one of those things that I don't think any of us really think about unless you are in the funeral industry, which is how this bill came about. A local funeral home here in Idaho Falls, the owner approached Stephanie Mickelson, Republican lawmaker from our area, and said, I have these ashes that have never been claimed, that are years old, And we spoke with another funeral home that said they have a closet full of these, urns full of ashes, bodies are cremated, and then they're never claimed. With the popularity of cremation on the rise, these funeral homes are worried that this could become a bigger problem. And so Stephanie Mickelson is proposing that maybe after 1 year, the ashes, funeral homes can dispose of the ashes in humane ways and in appropriate ways. The funeral homes have kind of pushed back and said 1 year might be a little too soon. Maybe it could be 3 to 5 years, but as long as there are some guidelines, because as of now, they don't really know what to do with these cremains.
So this is, she has proposed this bill. So of course that doesn't mean that it will go much farther, but I do think this is very interesting, Nate. I mean, and you do have a story up on your website. I mean, where you even show a boxed up urns in storage at a funeral home in downtown Idaho Falls.
Yeah, this is the Coltrane Funeral Home. That's one of them. The person we spoke with there said that they have 10 urns, some as old as 10 years. They've just been sitting there on the shelf. Mm. And there's a multitude of reasons why people might not claim the cremains. Some they don't want to pay for them to have them shipped. Mm-hmm. Some can't afford it. Some they don't like the person who died. And then there are some that they don't know why. There might be no other, you know, family relations in the area, or someone who just wishes not to pick them up. So these funeral homes are left with this kind of odd problem. And they'd hate to do something with them and then have a family member come back and say, where are the cremains? Because then you're looking at legal issues. They want to make sure it's ethically.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's fascinating, Nate. So yeah, appreciate that update. Scott and Christina, you have both been following these issues surrounding Ryan Coles. Christina, let's start with you and give us some background on Ryan Coles for folks who may not be familiar or maybe have forgotten about this. And then from there, tell us this latest news in regards to his medical license, at least in the state of Washington.
Yeah, so Dr. Ryan Cole is someone that we've been following since we launched about 3 years ago. He's an Idaho pathologist who has been accused of and now found of spreading COVID disinformation while essentially serving as an appointed Idaho health official. He has traveled the world. We've done investigations about his public appearances where he says that ivermectin is an effective way to treat COVID, that masks are ineffective, but especially that vaccines, the COVID vaccine is detrimental to people's health. And the Washington Medical Commission, where Dr. Cole also has a medical license, announced this week that they are going to restrict his medical license in the state of Washington after state regulators essentially concluded that he knowingly shared disinformation about COVID-19 and about prescribing ivermectin. This restricts his license for about 5 years from practicing primary care and for prescribing medication. And so they also kind of laid out some things that he needs to do to keep his medical license after those 5 years. So he must complete medical education courses. He also has to write a 1,000-word essay focused on honesty in medicine. So he has to complete these classes about respiratory diseases, medical record keeping, how to provide telehealth, these sort of things. And, you know, this has been, you know, essentially 3 years in the making since the pandemic began. He's also been ordered to pay $5,000 worth of fines. The big question about this is, how does this relate to Idaho? There are some laws that would allow Idaho officials to see that reciprocity and do the same thing in Idaho. But the public laws about disclosure about these sort of decisions are also very different between the state of Washington and the state of Idaho. So when we contacted the Idaho Board of Medicine, they said that they could not answer specific questions about how this decision would affect Cole's medical license in Idaho. And we've had written stories about how how Idaho law differs from Washington law, including that we wouldn't have even known about the investigation in Idaho, which the Idaho Board of Medicine, I think it's important to point out, closed before even looking at some of these patients' records when folks made complaints to the Idaho Board. So I know it's kind of a long recap. It's been a long mm-hmm. process with Idaho, with Cole's public pronunciations about COVID. And I think we'll be continuing to follow this to see if he does follow up with some of those recommendations that the Washington Board mm-hmm. made.
So, Scott, I know you wrote an opinion piece on this because, as Christina just said, yesterday, I mean, the commission in the state of Washington banned him from practicing primary care or prescribing medications in the state of Washington. And your big question is, why can't Idaho do the same thing?
Right. And I mean, you read the Washington Medical Commission's report. It's very lengthy. It's very detailed. It outlines at least 19 specific instances in which Cole made false or misleading statements. Another interesting thing that I found in the report was that Ryan Cole was practicing medicine through a website, and he was chat messaging with patients some of whom were complaining of COVID symptoms. One had tested positive for COVID, and essentially he prescribed them ivermectin without examining them or without even talking to them. And so those were some of the details for the reasons that the Washington Medical Commission had taken the action to restrict his license and ban him from practicing primary care practice and prescribing medication. And so the question is, right, why can't Idaho Health Board do the same thing? Mm-hmm. I'll also remind listeners that Ryan Cole is still the medical expert on the Central District Health Board. He was appointed to that position a little over 2 years ago. And I think given the facts that are laid out in this medical commission report, I think it would be pretty easy pickings for at least the removal of him from the Central District Health Board and then reconsideration by the Idaho Medical Board to reconsider similar measures for his license here in Idaho.
Well, and I think, Scott, you brought up a good point about the fact that he is, you know, the medical expert on the Central District Health Board. And we all know that that was basically a political move to put him on that board 2 years ago in the midst of the pandemic and all of that. And now we have, you know, a doctor who has lost their license in another state, yet is still on a health board in the state right. of Idaho. That should raise some questions.
Right. And just one of the quotes from the Washington Medical Commission report, I think, says a lot. They said, quote, Cole's public false and misleading statements regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, COVID-19 vaccines, the use of ivermectin to treat COVID-19, and the effectiveness of masks are harmful and dangerous to individual patients, generate mistrust in the medical profession and in public health, and have a widespread negative impact on the health and well-being of our communities. The exact opposite of what a health board is supposed to be doing.
So, Nate, heading back over to the Idaho legislature, lots of bills going on over there in the first couple of days. Tell us about this proposed legislation that would make sexually explicit AI-generated images of people illegal.
Well, this is a bill that a few lawmakers are working on, and they want to criminalize people who, I guess you could call it deep fakes, those deep fake images where you might put somebody's face on someone else's body or whatnot. And there's all sorts of sex abuse cases that detectives have said have become, it's a real problem in the porn industry. And so this would criminalize it. There's been other states that have done this, but not a lot, only four of them from what we found out that have passed laws that basically make it illegal for you to take someone's face and put it on naked bodies. Right now, there's really no recourse except civilly. You could sue somebody that does this to you. But they want to pass a law into Idaho to make it a criminal issue. And with the rise of social media and everybody being on phones and the technology and AI technology, that's one of the main things that these lawmakers hope to accomplish. And police are on board with this for the most part. The internet crimes against children, they're on board with it because they want to criminalize this activity that can really ruin somebody's life.
And Nate, I know in the article that you posted at eastidahonews.com, you did talk with some police officers, right, over in East Idaho. And have they seen anything like this? Or is it, I have to say, it is something that I've not thought of until I read your article. And I was like, oh, I could see this being a problem. Maybe not right now, but definitely as I think AI becomes so much more commonplace.
Yeah, and it's not really something that you want to think about, you know, and you wouldn't think about, I guess, unless you're involved in this really dark world. But yeah, they have seen it. They have actively investigated cases involving children and the use of AI. And they worry that it can get out of hand, and that by having some sort of legislation, it can hopefully crack down on it. And I would imagine that eventually you'll have all 50 states maybe taking legal action against this type of thing, especially when it involves children and when the technology is so new and it's constantly evolving. It's got to be something that they want to tackle right now.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I know you said four states there's only four states that have passed something like this, because there's nothing in federal law that outlaws this, at least at this point. But what there's something similar trying to be passed in the state of New York as well right now.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the law was one of the motivations for Representative Skog out of Nampa. He's working with Senator Cook here in Idaho Falls. Bruce Skog, he is an attorney who says that he's dealt with, I think his words were, stomach turning sex abuse cases over the years. And that's kind of the impetus for him getting this done. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that update. So Christina, I know you've been working with several of your sister newsroom outlets on a really big project. And this is about compensation to downwinders in Idaho, but in other states. So can we just start the conversation by explaining to our listeners what a downwinder is?
Yes, I'm actually so glad that we have time to talk about this one. This is a multi-state investigation that we have worked on with state's newsroom to talk about the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or it's known as RECA. In December, it was kind of the closest that Congress has gotten to passing legislation that would have provided compensation to Idahoans in specific counties who are downwinders, or basically who have developed cancer after radioactive contamination and exposure. So back in the 1940s, when we were developing the atom bomb, and between the 50s and 60s, there was, just dozens and hundreds of tests of nuclear weapons above ground in Nevada. And some of that radioactive material has traveled to different states in the West, but also in places like Missouri. And so they've dubbed themselves downwinders, these advocates that have been fighting for decades to get compensation for illness based on, the federal government's testing of these kinds of weapons. And this was, the Senate passed this RECA expansion, which our U.S. Senator Mike Crapo has been deeply involved in this process. And right at the end of December, when the when Congress was considering the National Defense Authorization Act, it was stripped from the act at the very last moment. And some of these advocates who have been fighting for this expansion of these benefits for decades have been left just deeply disappointed. They've described it as a betrayal. And so I know that this issue will come up again. The other thing is that the original RECA benefits and compensation expires in July. So there is a, kind of a ticking clock here on making sure that these people are taken care of. And we talked to the president of the Idaho Downwinders Association, who has essentially been just documenting cancer, leukemia, these sort of illnesses in Southern Idaho for decades and decades and decades. And you know, reading the other states' stories that have contributed to this project, some of these sentiments are the exact same for these people in different states. We've talked to people in Utah, we've talked to people in Montana, Arizona, New Mexico. They all have these same stories of really intense levels of cancer in their communities, and have just been devastated by not being able to pay for their healthcare and things like that for something that the federal government carried out.
So what's next in this then, Christina, with that payment going away, you said this summer?
Right. So, I think there are definitely folks that are working actively on this, including Senator Crapo, including Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri. They are determined. And of course, we have, some of these congressional budget decisions going on before we may have a partial government shutdown come January 19th. And so I think there really is motivation to reinsert this or to get other legislation passed to address this. I don't think this is the last time we'll hear of it. I don't think people are willing to give up on this. I do think it's something that that our senators are really taking a close look at and really advocating for.
And I would urge everyone, go to Idaho Capital Sun's website and read their article on this. It's really in depth and really worth the time to take that read. Hey, Nate, before we head out today, Idaho State University's Holt Arena is no longer Holt Arena. What's going on?
Yeah, you know, this is one of the iconic buildings in Pocatello. When you're driving up from Utah or driving down, you see it right off of I-15. Been there since 1970. It was renamed the Holt Arena back in the 1990s to honor Dubby Holt, who was the former athletic director. But as of this week, it is now called the ICCU Dome, the Idaho Central Credit Union Dome. This came after the credit union promised a $6 million donation over the course of 12 years. They just did a really big renovation on the Holt Arena, or I should say the ICCU Dome, with new seating and an improved president's deck and student meeting room. Anyway, the credit union is excited for this. Of course, Idaho State University is excited for this, as it gives them $6 million. And the Holt family, apparently, at least most of them are the ones that have spoken publicly, say that they are excited and that they're Dubby Holt, the original architect of it, would be excited because he was a businessman first and he understood the need to support student athletes. So don't think they've put up a new sign yet, but next time you're in Pocatello driving through, you might see a new sign on the building.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed, because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.